not only do you want to solve the disaster, you got to have some next step to how to ensure this disaster does not happen again.
The federal government declares a fisheries disaster for three areas of Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage braces for another big wind event this weekend.
There are certain areas where there's trees that are weak or leaning towards power lines. So we're actually going out and being proactive about taking down some of the more potentially dangerous trees.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Project Management Institute will present three one-day seminars at the Petroleum Club of Anchorage, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Expert Neil Whitten will present No-Nonsense Advice for Successful Projects, Let's Talk, More No-Nonsense Advice for Project Success, and The Gift of Wisdom, Work-Life Balance for Today's Managers, Learn to Manage Projects, and more. Registration information at pmiak.org. This message sponsored by Project Management Institute, Alaska Chapter.
The U.S. Department of Commerce has declared a fishery disaster for the Yukon and Kuskokwim Rivers and Cook Inlet. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, whether the aid ever materializes hinges on congressional action.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is part of the Commerce Department, announced the declaration for commercial fisheries. Kieran Clayton is with NOAA and says this is the first step to get aid to entire fishing communities, not just commercial operations.
It is technically a commercial fishery failure, but depending on the timing and nature of the appropriations, the disaster assistance may be available to support Alaskan natives this winter.
There are a number of uncertainties: how much Congress will allocate, how long it would take, and whether disaster funding could pass out the capital at all. Underscoring the uncertainty, Alaska's U.S. senators say it's unclear whether subsistence fishermen will get any aid. They cautioned against too much excitement. It took about a year for people to receive money after the last fishery disaster was declared in 2009. Senator Mark Begich says this is the first move in the right direction.
So I think our first stage is we had to get a disaster declared. Now the next stage is how to get the funding and then focus on how we make sure that funding goes to the right folks in Alaska.
Those last two will prove difficult. A year ago, lawmakers threatened to partially shut down the government over disaster funding. Historically, Congress approves emergency aid without requiring a matching cut in spending elsewhere. That changed last September, and that specter looms large over disaster relief again. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she does not know whether some budget hawks will force matching cuts, but there are a number of lawmakers from all over the map who need federal help, and that could help Alaskans in need.
Whether it's tornadoes or floods or hurricanes, droughts, there's clearly fair amount of disaster relief that is being sought.
There's another factor working in the state's favor. NOAA also declared fish disasters in the Northeast and Mississippi, meaning more lawmakers have an interest in assuring the money makes it through Congress. But just how much money would be made available remains unclear. Senator Begich says between $35 and $45 million would be appropriate.
Not only do you want to solve the disaster, you got to have some next step to how to ensure this disaster does not happen again. And I think part of that's the research and monitoring that's necessary.
It's unclear whether you can prevent weak salmon runs in the future, so there may be another reason for requesting that much money. In 2009, the state asked for $10 million and ended up with $5 million. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Kuskokwim Chinook salmon run was so poor this year that an unprecedented 12-day subsistence closure was implemented. Still, fishery managers don't think enough kings have reached the spawning grounds. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart reports.
All the facts and figures are not in yet. In fact, Travis Ellison with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says the final Kuskokwim salmon report won't be available for months. But he says the agency can make an educated guess.
As you know, from all the subsistence restrictive actions we had to take this summer, it was a poor king run, for sure.
This year, that run came unseasonably late on the Kuskokwim.
It was the lowest run we've had in recent years, lower than even 2010 and 11 for total run size, just based off of Bethel test fishery.
That means to date, the 2012 Kuskokwim King Run is the lowest recorded since the program started in 1984. And that spells bad news for escapement numbers, which according to data compiled through mid-August, are well below what they were projected to be and likely will not meet their goals this year. Ellison says that though the numbers may be less than stellar, they are not the worst on record.
It looks like escapements overall were probably higher than 2010 and 2011. You know, if you want to read into it, it does look like those restrictive actions did help to get more fish to the spawning grounds.
Ellison says King subsistence harvest estimates will not be available until January or February. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Anchorage residents are bracing for another powerful windstorm. The National Weather Service is predicting the winds will pick up Saturday afternoon and peak Sunday morning. It is the second major wind event to hit the area in less than 2 weeks. National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Snyder says these types of storms should be rare this early in the fall.
In the wintertime, or very late fall anyway, we usually have a couple days of separation between storms. This time of the year we have maybe a week or more, but when we're in this type of pattern, we're missing that layer of protection in the lowest part of the atmosphere, that cold that sinks down to the ground and makes the frost on the cars and the fog in the morning. But when we have that, it usually protects us from some of those stronger winds, and that's what makes this type of storm somewhat unusual for our region at this time of the year, because we don't have that and we're noticing the winds because of that lack of stable air close to the ground.
Forecasters are predicting wind gusts of around 100 miles per hour on the hillside and along Turnagain Arm Saturday night and Sunday morning. The lower hillside and the rest of Anchorage could have gusts of up to 65 miles per hour during the same period. The strongest winds should subside by Sunday afternoon. Damage estimates for the September 4th storm in Anchorage are already in the millions of dollars, and the municipality of Anchorage is asking people to wait until this next storm is over to submit any more damage reports. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The strength of last Tuesday's big windstorm caught Anchorage by surprise. The winds that lashed the city hit more than 130 miles per hour in one unconfirmed report on the hillside. Wind and rain walloped the city, taking down trees, damaging rooftops, and leaving thousands across the municipality without power for days, and in some cases, nearly a week. Mayor Dan Sullivan chalks it up to a learning experience.
Clearly, the last storm highlighted the need to improve communications, and so the utilities are working to make sure that their social media is active. And clearly, when power lines are down, but your phone is still working, you know, having the ability to access Facebook or Twitter really is a big help. The other thing we're doing is we know from all the repairs that we've done that there are certain areas where there's trees that are weak or leaning towards power lines. So we're actually going out and being proactive about taking down some of the more potentially dangerous trees.
The municipality is in the process of assessing how extensive the damage from the September 4th windstorm actually is. They hope to put a monetary value on it soon, but Mayor Sullivan says it will take some time to come up with a good estimate.
It'll probably be a few weeks before we're able to really tally all the additional costs.
Dawn Brantley is Emergency Programs Manager for the Anchorage Office of Emergency Management. She says the municipality plans to submit a preliminary damage assessment to the Alaska Department of Homeland Security sometime next week.
A preliminary damage assessment is just a general overview of the amount of damage, associated costs, and the cost of responding to an emergency or disaster, so that we can determine if an emergency proclamation is either warranted or that we meet a threshold set by the state.
Brantley says the municipality is still gathering information in a variety of ways, including through a damage survey on their website for businesses and homeowners. To date, 6 businesses and 158 homeowners have filed reports. The municipality is also working with law enforcement to gather information.
They have designated areas that they go out and they drive, and they take pictures and make estimates of damage and document those areas. So we've asked all of the municipally owned facilities to report in their damage and their response costs as well.
One of the biggest costs the municipality is looking at is to the power companies. Brantley says if this next storm proves to be as powerful as forecasters predict, people may want to hold off on filing a report until it's over so they can include any new damage. Phil Steyer with Chugach Electric Cooperative, which bore the brunt of the damage from the storm, says that although costs are still coming in, they're looking at a preliminary estimate of $2 million. The Matanuska Electric Association and MLNP don't have estimates yet. Once the municipality has gathered all the information they need, officials will make the call on whether to submit a request for a disaster declaration. Jeremy Zedek with the Alaska Department of Homeland Security says generally it takes pretty serious damage for a disaster to be declared, though.
In order for a disaster declaration to be made, the event has to be severe, widespread, and have an impact to life safety, critical infrastructure.
With another storm on the horizon, officials say it's possible two or more storms could be rolled into one report and one request for disaster assistance. Whether this weekend's storm will deliver the second punch is the looming question. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a group of friends on a long trip south take stock of the journey so far.
When people ask what's the best part of the trip, it's hard to say because it seemed like almost every day we were saying this is the best day of the trip.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
An Anchorage police officer was wounded earlier today during a shootout at an Anchorage motel. APD spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker said the shooting took place at the Merrill Field Inn. The motel was evacuated and Fifth Avenue, one of the main traffic arteries into the city, was shut down for about 2 hours. Parker says it all began when two APD officers were investigating a burglary.
We made contact with two people, a male and a female, not realizing that there was a male in the bathroom. They recognized what they thought might be evidence of the burglary, and at that time, the male in the bathroom fired shots at the officers. One of the officers was struck. We believe his injuries are non-life-threatening. They returned fire immediately, were able to extricate the man and the woman that he had been talking to.
The injured officer and the two people in the motel room were taken to safety, and a SWAT team was called in to negotiate with the shooter, whom Parker says police believe was wounded during the return gunfire. The suspect, as yet unnamed, surrendered to police officers at about 1:30 this afternoon. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan is asking for budget cuts, and one of the departments being targeted is the Anchorage Police Department. The mayor says the city is facing a $30 million shortfall for next year's budget. Derek Scher is president of the Officers Union. He says APD's budget is $80 million, and the mayor is proposing a 10% cut, or $8 million. The chief of police will make recommendations for where to find those savings, but Scher says there isn't much room for trimming.
I cannot fathom a way to get cuts of that magnitude in the department, which without going to personnel, the bulk of the cost of our department, like almost any department, is in labor costs. I mean, we are a direct service provider through our staff to the community. So in order to realize that savings, you're going to have to cut bodies. And we simply do not have the non-sworn or support staff positions available to get that type of savings, so they would have to cut sworn positions. And I think that's a generally accepted idea at this point.
How many officers does APD have currently?
The Anchorage Police Department currently has about 375 officers, some of whom are still in training, but most of them are working the street or in investigative assignments.
Do you know how this compares to other cities of a similar size, the number of officers?
Yeah, the Anchorage Police Department has a very low staffing to population or officer per 1,000 ratio compared to other cities. My guess is we probably have the lowest on the West Coast for a city of our size. And then the other problem that we face in Anchorage is we don't have overlapping jurisdictions. In other words, we don't have, for example, a county sheriff's department or something like that that would lie over the top of us. And then the additional issue that we face is we don't have adjacent jurisdictions of sufficient size to provide mutual aid.
Beyond the concern over your fellow officers possibly being laid off, you've been working in law enforcement for nearly two decades. What are your thoughts about the issues of adequate coverage by police for city safety if these cuts happen?
Well, right now, I know, you know, they're looking at somewhere north of potentially 30 sworn positions, and these would be live body layoffs. If that actually occurred, which, you know, the process is ongoing and we've got quite a ways to go, and I have confidence that, you know, after the mayor's office and the assembly have a chance to weigh in on it, that cuts of that magnitude are hopefully going to be avoided. But if something like that did occur, it would be pretty dramatic for the community and the department. Ultimately, we would probably have to make up those shortages with overtime.
Derek Scher is president of the Police Officers Union. He says the state troopers have already started recruiting Anchorage police officers to fill 40 open positions. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan says he wants to balance budget cutting with maintaining appropriate staff levels for all municipal departments. But if other efficiencies can't be found, he says, reductions in the police force will have to happen.
We know for the police, our goal is that we don't lose bodies. They actually have good number of vacant positions that would be our first opportunity to find savings if we had to get into the personnel end of things. So you look at the vacant positions first, and then if we can't find enough savings elsewhere, then all departments, again, may have a loss of personnel.
The mayor will present his final budget plan to the Anchorage Assembly on October 1st. The Matanuska-Susitna Borough is one of a handful of areas in the United States designated by Easter Seals for a program aimed at better assisting disabled and elderly bus riders. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Public transportation for disabled and elderly riders has long been a problem in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. But now, thanks to Easter Seals, a number of transportation services are getting together to do something about it. Easter Seals' Project Action sent facilitators to Wasilla for 2 days of workshops aimed at designing a new approach to an old problem. David Levy is executive director of the Alaska Mobility Coalition. Levy says the goal is to come out with a strategy to outline an accessible transportation plan in the valley right now.
There are transportation needs between the Matsu Valley and Anchorage Commuter Service. There is transportation needs within the urban parts of the valley, which is Wasilla and Palmer. And there's also a need from the rural parts of the borough, from like Talkeetna and Willow, into Wasilla and Palmer for services. So they're kind of these overlapping transportation needs and trying to coordinate that into one system.
Lamar Anderson heads the borough's Transportation Advisory Board, a volunteer committee that looks at a variety of transportation issues in the borough and gives recommendations to the Planning Commission, which provides direct input into the borough assembly.
There are a lot of gaps. There's a lot of needs. It's struggling because it is growing, and you have different transportation providers who are doing their best with their particular routes or their particular missions, but trying to put more heads together in terms of how we can collaborate, cooperate better to use our available resources so that we can improve the ridership options for the Valley residents.
Anderson says more bus stops and more routes are some of the basic issues being addressed. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Falls are the leading cause of workplace fatalities in the construction industry. Your family's well-being depends on you staying healthy during the work season. Employers, for no-cost safety and health consultation and training services, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health at 1-800-656-4972. This message sponsored by the Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
A new study is adding another dimension to the sea otter debate. The research shows the marine mammals help reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a major contributor to climate change. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Jim Estes remembers taking a look around the bottom of Sitka Sound about 20 years ago.
When we were diving in that area back in the early 90s, the seafloor was just covered with urchins. And there were, you know, there was virtually no kelp. There was urchins everywhere. 2 years ago, when we went back and looked at the same sites, there was not an urchin to be found, and there was kelp everywhere.
Estes is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California campus in Santa Cruz. His latest research takes a look at kelp forests and how much carbon dioxide they absorb. The otter connection comes because they eat sea urchins, which in turn eat kelp. Working with other researchers, Estes took a look at coastal waters with no sea otters and those with a full population.
The effects of sea otters in that system on carbon dioxide concentration would be significant. And by significant, I mean whether or not you have otters in the system would account for roughly an estimated approximately 10% of the total carbon. That's a lot.
And by cutting carbon dioxide, otters also reduce ocean acidification, which results from CO2 dissolving in water.
That's a whole other area of work that we and others have been looking at. But if, for example, you look at pH, which is a measure of acidification, and you measure it inside a kelp forest and then, say, a couple hundred yards away, it's always higher within the kelp forest, which means that the acidification level is lower.
He wants to be clear that the changes would only be in affected coastal areas, not worldwide. Otter populations are booming in southeast Alaska, and that's brought a lot of attention from fishermen, economists, and biologists. The new study focuses on waters from southern British Columbia to the end of the Aleutian Islands. Southeast and most other areas lost their populations to Russian and American hunters about a century ago. Otters were reintroduced over the past 50 years. In an earlier interview, Phil Doherty of the Southeast Alaska Dive Fisheries Association said their rapid spread and voracious appetite hits his members hard.
The areas that are the most affected are the areas that have the largest food source, and those are the species that we harvest, and those are sea urchins, sea cucumbers, and gooey duck clams.
Sea otters are a protected species, and only Alaska natives can hunt them. There are also strict limits on how their pelts can be sold or used. Some commercial fishermen and native groups have called for measures allowing more to be harvested. Otter supporters have fought for continued protection, in part because kelp forests offer shelter that boosts salmon, herring, and rockfish populations. The new research adds to those arguments, but Estes doesn't want to exaggerate impacts on the planet's overall carbon dioxide levels.
It's going to be pretty small. We haven't made that calculation, but, you know, this is just a teeny little part of the world. And so I don't think the story really is relevant on a global scale. It just demonstrates a process on a local scale.
The study first appeared in the publication Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Trip South gang is ready for the next step in their adventure. Back in June, the group of 20-somethings from Juneau launched an epic kayak and bike trip from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego at the southern tip of South America. The paddling portion recently ended in Ladysmith, British Columbia, and after taking a couple of weeks off, the group plans to begin the bike portion this weekend. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Before setting out, Kanan Bosler was expecting the trip of a lifetime. So far, he says it's been that and so much more.
Basically, you know, when people ask what's the best part of the trip, it's hard to say because it seemed like almost every day we were saying this is the best day of the trip.
After leaving Juneau in their kayaks on June 1st, the group spent almost 100 days on the water before reaching Ladysmith, British Columbia earlier this month. Bosler is spending the time between the kayak and bike portions of the trip at Quest University in Squamish, B.C., where he graduated last year. He's using the downtime to put together a short video about their adventure so far. Some of the footage likely will be featured in a longer documentary about the trip.
This film project has really turned out to be a great way of doing a trip like this because it just gives us an excuse to go into these really unique places and go out there and find the smartest person living there and just have a good excuse to have a deep conversation with them.
Bosler says a conversation with Cake Village elder Mike Jackson had an especially profound effect on him.
He was actually the very first person that we recorded a conversation with, and it was very cool to hear, you know, all of the things that they use, both in food, and he's an artist and a crafts maker, so he's constantly harvesting from the area and using those resources to maintain his lifestyle.
The core of the Trip South group consists of Bosler, Chris Hinckley, Andrew Francis, Colin Flynn, and Max Stanley. The Funky Five, as they call themselves, were joined by about 10 friends for portions of the paddling trip, as well as other boaters they met along the way. More friends and family undoubtedly will join for various legs of the bike journey. Hinckley, who's currently on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, says the shift to biking will take some getting used to, but he's ready for it.
I'm sure glad that I'm not going to have to unload that kayak and haul it up the beach every night. So kind of a different way of moving, and it'll be a lot faster. Obviously, now all of a sudden we're going from 10 miles a day to 10 miles an hour.
But Hinckley says the group doesn't plan to hurry. After all, part of the reason for doing the trip was to see the world at a leisurely pace and get to know some new people along the way.
I think everyone has a little bit of this experience when you go out traveling. It just seems you attract all these people, and it seems like you meet more people than you might meet in your everyday life. I can't tell you how many times we were invited into people's homes to share a meal and to kind of just talk and share stories.
Hinckley says they hope to start the bike trip on Saturday. The group plans to follow the Pacific coast all the way through North and South America. Several local companies, including Nugget Alaska Outfitter and Cycle Alaska, have donated money and gear. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mark Earhart in Bethel, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, and Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein. Online at lbblawyers.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.